Okay, it's December 20th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Jules Carlin. Mr. Carlin, I was hoping you could start by just talking a little bit about your personal history and your educational background. What brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana in the first place?
It was pure circumstance. I had no intention. Well, I better start at the beginning. You want to know where my degrees are from?
Yeah.
I took my bachelor's degree at Georgetown School of Foreign Service. And then I went to Chapel Hill for a master's degree. And then I had the misfortune of going to Minnesota for a doctorate. I say misfortune because it was a school of 15,000, which was huge then. And I never became accustomed to it. Mm. The department was excellent. But I hated the climate. I hated the size. I felt that when you had 500 students at a lecture, it was unconscionable. And then the war started after I had done a semester at a state teachers college. Those times jobs were hard to get. And I finally came out to Pullman to teach in the Army program. And then from Pullman, I went to Seattle to teach in the history department. And from Seattle, I went to Tacoma to teach in the summer school. And in the course of all these movings around, I met Paul Phillips, of whom you've heard.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to put me to work in the archives in Seattle. I didn't want to be an archivist. So Montana then had a vacancy for 1 year by M.C. Wren, and Burley Miller, having been told about me by Paul Phillips, asked me if I was interested, and since the courses weren't the courses I would normally teach, I said no. Then Herman Deutsch of Washington State, who had taught here in the 20s, came to Seattle and we had lunch. I happened to remark to him about the Montana questions, and he recommended it highly, said that Burley would let me draw up my own schedule, and he said, resurrect it. So I resurrected it, and Burley made me an offer to take M.C. Wren's place for 1 year, and I'm still here.
You know, I have heard that a similar story from many people who became faculty here, that they came on a one-year contract and just never left. So what were your interests at the time? You know, you mentioned
my interests were American diplomatic history and American constitutional history, plus political theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about all I knew.
Mm-hmm. And so did it come to pass that you were able to design your own courses?
Mm-hmm. With the Burley helped me kill a course I couldn't drop but didn't want to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Burley was an extraordinary chairman. You probably have heard him mentioned.
I have, but tell me a little about him.
Well, he was originally from Kansas, came out here, and was chairman of the history department. And also, became an administrator, and dean of men. When he retired as dean of men in about 1947, the students came to his house, got him, and took him to the university theater, and celebrated him with him. The one ex-student of mine who casually said, "Well, Burley was very fair. He bailed me out, listened to the case on the spot, then threw me out." So the university at that time was run by what was known as the Whig oligarchy.
And what does that mean?
That means that it was run by four old-timers with perceptions of what a university should be. Burley was one of them. Mr. Leapart, who was dean of the law school, was the second. H.G. Merriam of the English was third. And the fourth member was R.H. Jesse, who was a chemist. Mm-hmm. And they ran the university.
In what way did they run it? And what do you mean by they ran it as they thought a university should be run? How did they think it should be run?
Well, they got rid of as many survey courses as they could.
Mm-hmm.
Then they played to Montana's strengths. In other words, we had no deans except for the professional schools. So there was a vacuum in the leadership. And this was 10 years after the Simmons affair. So somebody had to take charge, and the four mm-hmm. gentlemen took mm-hmm. charge.
Mm-hmm. Who was the president at the time when you came?
Jimmy McCain mm-hmm. came at the same time I did.
And what year was that?
1945. Jimmy and I were regular tennis partners, since we were almost the only ones who played, and since the courts were so terrible. So the students complained to Jimmy about the courts, and he said, well, let's appoint a committee to decide what we should do. So it was decided the students would appoint two and Jimmy would appoint one. And I learned quickly how you could manipulate administrations, because Jimmy watched as the students selected one girl from Illinois who was a tennis player and another girl from Missoula, which would make Jimmy's appointment the key vote. And he appointed me.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that's what I call administration.
Mm-hmm. So you got new courts.
Oh, yes. We did everything correct, almost everything correctly. We sent out questionnaires, even though Mary Morrow and I knew in advance what we were going to do.
You know, you mentioned both your experience at a university where you got your PhD of 15,000 and you thought it was unconstitutional to have classes with 500 people in it. And also the four gentlemen who, you know, tried to get rid of as many survey courses as possible. What about survey courses or large courses did you find unconstitutional?
Unconscionable.
Unconscionable. Yeah, I mean, you know, now we're here at the university in a time where having lots of students sign up for your course is, of course, sort of a feather in your cap.
I could never claim that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been frequently run with five students or mm-hmm. less, or fewer to be grammatical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find with the surveys, you have a tendency to use graduate assistants, and graduate assistants should be doing their own work instead of the universities. Then graduate assistants are underpaid, they're overworked, and then a survey is simply skipping from high point to high point.
Mm-hmm.
The first survey to go was the chemistry survey. I think they call it some kind of science.
So you came in with McCain, and he lasted for quite a while as a president here.
5 years.
Compared to some subsequent.
And Jimmy would have stayed longer, except that he and a statewide committee had gotten a bond issue through, and then the examiners, I think we've abandoned the examiners, what did precisely they do? Oh, they reasserted their control over the money. So Montana got less than it, university got less than it expected, and Havre got more.
Hmm.
And Havre got more because one of the examiners was from Havre,
mm-hmm.
Sam Mitchell, whose his name is on a building in Helena.
Mm-hmm.
So Jimmy was unhappy with that. And then Kansas State made him a good offer. And he departed.
Mm-hmm. Before we get too much into the changing of administration here at the university, I want to talk a little bit more about the history department in particular. You came in and you were able to design your own courses. Tell me a little bit about the department in 1945, the people and the curriculum.
Well, Burley Miller was chairman. Paul Phillips was on leave, but you've read about the trial.
I don't believe I recall a trial.
Oh.
In the history department?
The downtown.
Mm-hmm.
He was accused of having made advances to a female student.
Ah, yeah, and Merriam wrote about this in his History of the University.
Yes.
Yes, right. So he was on leave for that.
And since he ultimately won his case, the university had to restore him to his position.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pathetic. Poor Paul used to walk around the campus with his head down. They destroyed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Earl Bennett, who was had a Wisconsin PhD. What can I say about Earl without being nasty? Well, he was a bad lecturer and not a scholar. Then there was Bob Turner, who taught European history and was an exceptionally talented teacher. He died very early, heart attack. And then there was M.C. Wren, one of nature's sons of bitches.
Why do you say that about him?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to have an oral history of M.C. Wren?
Yeah, a brief one.
Yeah.
I mean, he was chair of the department at the time, or soon thereafter. No. He served as chair, didn't he?
Yes, but mm-hmm. 15 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of Paul Carter?
No, I haven't.
Well, he was one of those fired by Wren.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I should start at the beginning about MC. Well, he came back after his year of leave, and Brilliant decided to keep me. And I was coaching the university tennis team.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a small town then, no Reserve Street. I liked it. So I stayed. And then Wren discovered I wasn't attending the social science lectures. Not only wasn't I attending the lectures, but I wasn't listening to Harold Tasche, a sociologist, repeat his lecture for the benefit of the instructors. So they went to Tasche and Wren went to Jimmy McCain. This was after I'd been here for 2 years, and asked Jimmy to fire me. So Jimmy said he couldn't fire me. The chairman makes decisions. So then Burley went to see McCain about getting me a promotion and increase in salary. Jimmy said, I can't give him both. We play tennis together regularly. But he said, he can have one or the other. Just ask him which one he wants. So Burley told me, by all means, take the cash, because you can get a promotion around here readily, but cash, no.
So half the department had you on the chopping block that the chair was going to bat for you.
Yes, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then after I survived that, I got into trouble with the new president, Carl McFarland, who replaced McCain. And you've heard about McFarland, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
The best line I've read about McFarland is Leslie Fiedler's line in his in H.G. Merriam's book, that McFarland was a master of bad public relations. True.
Mm-hmm.
And he dreamed that this would be the Harvard of the West, and contributed to its not being the Harvard of the West.
How so?
Well, he was convinced that he knew more than anybody else. He was a Montana AB, LLB, and then he made a fortune in Indian law, came back to run the law at the university. And he was, he became acquainted with me early because he had given the Clover Bowl to the high school for band practice at 11 o'clock in the morning. Well, I had a class in political theory overlooking the area, and the band was a damn nuisance. So I wrote the McFarland a note urging him to withdraw his permission, saying the band and Plato could never coexist. Well, he got barely on the telephone and raised hell with me for Les Majesty, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he met with Chairman, he zeroed in on me in this meeting with Burley and said I should be dismissed, that I couldn't teach, and Kirk Baddeley, who was a gentleman and served as graduate manager of athletics and also as treasurer of the university, he said that his son said I was the best instructor on the campus, which I think was overstating the case. But in any event, Burley wouldn't give way, so all McFarland could do was hold me in rank and hold me in salary.
Mm-hmm.
But he was making so many enemies so rapidly, I figured that I would outlive him. And so it came about.
Mm-hmm. So that's two presidents, and both of them have been pushed to fire you or else take it upon themselves to fire you. So who comes in after that?
Only one of them wanted to fire me.
Uh-huh.
Jimmy didn't. Jimmy wouldn't.
Right, right. He was asked to fire you.
Oh, yes. That was a frequent reaction.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, usually when I've talked to people about their initial experiences in their departments, I often get the description that the university was very collegial at the time and personable and friendly, and faculty and staff got along marvelously. You're not necessarily painting that picture for me right now.
Oh, can you name a department which is collegial?
Well, I just came from an interview with someone in the math department who described the math department as collegial. I've even had the history department described for me as that.
Well, you've seen the Harvard, the guide to Harvard courses?
No.
Well, they call the history department the least viable. In other words, a brilliant teaching staff, all of whom hated each other.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you have David Donald and in company, you have a department, but when they don't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. So that was the case when you were in the history department early on?
Well, no, but it became that way later.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the department didn't survive, in my opinion, the purge of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. And what was that purge all about?
Well, again, Wren is at the foreground. He wanted to be chairman, but the department selected Oscar Hammond, who was a gentleman and a good scholar. And finally, Wren did so much politicking up and down the corridor that he got a majority. And so he was elected chairman in place of Oscar Hammond. And then as soon as he became chairman, the bloodshed started. He fired Hugh Beatty and about five other members of the department.
Mm-hmm.
I remonstrated with him, and I told him he suffered from bloodlust, which he did. And then finally, he said, well, he couldn't get rid of me unless I, since I had tenure, unless I committed to sexual offenses on the Oval, and gave me a full sophomore schedule. And of course, teaching sophomores was beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't.
Why is that?
I think I believed in scholarship and not... I hated lecturing in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then I held them to the same standards I would hold others. And, you know, the majors. I just wasn't good with sophomores.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, Wren went off to the University of Maryland's overseas program. And then acting chairman was Mort Borden, was a friend of mine. So he told me, go to Helena and do my research, leave the course behind, and I'll take care of it. So I got a lot of work done.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have had people comment to me about your teaching methods and style, and your dislike of large lecture classes. Tell me about your teaching method and style and what you were doing at the time.
Well, the course I preferred to teach was political theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the whole class would say, read Plato's Politics or Machiavelli's The Prince. Then we would discuss it. I would ask what I thought were Socratic questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that way they retain more and analyze more.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to have done the reading. So frequently I would lose students who just didn't want all that work in the spring quarter.
Mm-hmm.
It was a three-quarter course. And then I finally lost the political theory.
Well, at some point, the political science department was created separate from the history department.
It was created. I got here and we had only one department.
Mm-hmm.
And no political scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a couple of years, we got a political scientist named Ellis Waldron. And then we picked up another one named Tom Paine. And they were really...
Name.
What?
An appropriate name.
Yes, considering he came from Westminster College in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And was suitably pious and suitably Republican. But he had been confronted consistently by the problem of my teaching political theory, because when the two departments separated, the political scientists had agreed to let me have the political theory as so long as I was here, and then it would, as soon as I left, the course would evolve and be taught by political scientists. Well, they got tired by the about 1960, of waiting for the political theory class, and they got a new, they got a new dean of the College of Arts and Science, a guy named Bob Coomrod, another clown. He came from the Ford Foundation, where, you know, they had a, what I would consider, a program to train administrators. And this guy, Coomrod, was the last one to be placed. He was a historian, by the way. Hmm. You've heard about him?
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, he was a historian. He had taught at Arizona State before going to the Ford Foundation. Well, in any event, the political scientists convinced him that the welfare of the students was more important than their commitment to me. Because they claimed that a number of their students had to have political theory but were afraid to take it with me.
Well, I have heard that many students would start your course and then weed themselves out of it. What's the truth in that? Or is there any truth in it?
Of course.
Uh-huh.
I would say probably it's reasonably accurate.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? Was it your method or approach to it?
I feel that the only way you're going to get any place academically is by working. So I have had them work. 1,000 pages of reading with notes. Then I didn't use textbooks. I used the Heath series, you know, those problem books.
Mm-hmm.
So if you weren't willing to work consistently, you shouldn't have taken the course.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm. So were you more inclined to be working with graduate students?
Look, we had very few graduate students.
Mm.
But I did have about a dozen.
You know, now there are not only a healthy number of graduate students, but they've restarted the PhD program in the history department. Were there not many graduate students at the time because there simply wasn't interest or there weren't the facilities for it?
We lacked the staff, mm-hmm. the facilities, and the placement skills,
mm-hmm.
if you want to call them skills.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we couldn't compete with Harvard.
And was there any interest at the time in getting to that level?
Not on the department. Not on the department's side.
Mm-hmm.
No, the department didn't propose the PhD in the first place. Killed it in the second. Then it was resurrected since I left the department.
Mm-hmm. Were you in favor of moving towards graduate study?
I felt we could teach undergraduates very well.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have 2,000 students, you can't give a legitimate PhD, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't fair to the students.
So after World War II, most universities, in fact, grew due to people coming home and starting in on higher education. Was that the case here at UM? Or did the end of the war change this university at all in any way?
Well, I came here after the war and it was 1,800 students.
Mm-hmm.
And we made slow process. We really stressed the undergraduate work.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other strengths of the department at the time?
Well, we were essentially a teaching department. And And we were strong in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Then we killed the social science survey. Pardon me. We killed the social science survey.
Mm-hmm.
So that we were set up to handle undergraduates. Then we had some very good people. Paul Carter, you may have read about him in Merriam's book. He married a co-ed, then taught, he was the son of a Methodist minister, graduate of Wesleyan, and he was Richard Hofstadter's first PhD candidate,
mm-hmm.
according to a new book about Hofstadter. And Paul was an idealist, but an excellent teacher, very good with the discussion. But as Merriam points out, he was opposed to the Vietnamese War, and Harry K. Newbern, who became president briefly, encouraged Wren to fire him. And the AUP wouldn't come to Paul's rescue because they said that he did have 7 years in, which was the equivalent. But one of the years was as a lecturer at Columbia, and they couldn't count a lecturership in the 7 years. So Paul went to four different colleges in 4 years, Stanford, Smith, etc. And then he got this job at Arizona and published four more books. Mort Borden left because he had delivered a talk at a farmers' gathering in Billings, and he said that co-ops were as American as apple pie, and Tim Babcock, who was the governor, a lunatic fringe right, I think pressed Harry K. to get rid of him. But Mort was astute. He left under his own steam and went to Santa Barbara,
mm-hmm.
which he liked immensely, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Who wouldn't?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so we did have a good department, but the casualty list was enormous.
Mm-hmm.
One man I know, who was here only briefly, decided that he was in danger of being fired with everybody else being dismissed, so he moved on to Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Nebraska. He had a Maryland PhD.
So, you know, that sort of coincides with the time frame that in which the university became known as the as a graveyard for presidents, because the presidents were turning over so quickly.
This is they always do. After all, this is a small state. The legislature is customarily and almost indifferent to the university system. You can't handle six separate parts of a university with a population of less than 800,000, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So presidents would come and discover that the obstacles to doing what they want to do are insurmountable. In other words, this became a jumping off place.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 60s, we came up with, I would say from Jimmy McCain's time to Bob Panza's time, we came up with a whole series of lemons.
And how was Panza different?
He had common sense. This is what I mean by when I say he has common sense. I was chairman of a committee dealing with recreation facilities, and we were getting bonds from Snowball, because, and people, and then the men who were turning them in were getting, of course, tax breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So the skiers, I knew nothing about skiing, and this, but the skiers, but I appointed a committee of five skiers to tell me what should be done, tell the whole committee what should be done. And they came back and said the place is out of functional order, that the higher up you have beginner slopes, down below you have so on. So they recommended that the university take over the ski run and then rebuild it.
Mm-hmm.
It would be excellent recreation. So we presented our report to Bob Panzer, and Panzer and I met, and he said, I can't go along with you. He said, have you ever studied the balance sheet of a ski run? In a year when there's no snow? He said, this could cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he made for almost perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. So the university never took over Snowball?
No, it never took over.
And it's wildly successful to this day.
It is?
It's fairly successful.
Are they making money?
Enough to stay open.
That's just about what I'd suspected.
Right. They don't seem to be developing a world-class resort up there.
That was their aim.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bob, we had a guy in the English department who wrote 40 stories, allegedly 40 stories, and Panzer came to his rescue.
Who was that?
The guy?
Mm-hmm.
What? I'm drawing a blank on it. It's in Merritt's book anyway. What was his name?
He wrote Fiction About the West, right?
Not Leslie Fiedler.
No. See the guy from Idaho? He wrote about the Snake River country.
Never heard.
I think he taught here for a few years.
Oh, really?
We'll come up with his name. But McFarland had to deal with the bad PR from him writing supposedly body stories.
And then Panzer defended him.
Mm-hmm.
Panzer defended, I would say he defended the faculty, which has always been difficult to deal with.
Hmm.
Don't misunderstand me. You noticed, for example, George proposed that they eliminate this ridiculous winter quarter.
Yes.
And how the faculty rose almost as one,
mm-hmm,
to defend their prerogatives.
And President Dennison.
Pardon me?
And President Dennison saw the light.
Yeah.
According to the faculty.
George is going to have to discover some other method of killing it.
Mm-hmm. I suspect so.
Though it's going to be difficult because it becomes part of the faculty prerogatives.
Mm-hmm. So how about your own research while you were here? You mentioned going off to Helena.
Oh. My major work was a two-volume biography of Joe Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the Dixon papers, which were voluminous. And then Dixon figured in a number of Progressive Party biographies. And then I wrote an occasional article. I started off working on law violence against resident aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem was that the resident aliens most concerned were the Chinese, and I felt that you couldn't do research unless you knew the language. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know Chinese,
mm-hmm.
nor was I likely to learn. So Dixon was not only was a participant in the progressive movement, but he was also a mover.
And how did the university support research for its faculty?
Well, again, I was on a committee, and we had very little money.
Mm-hmm.
You normally had to get the money from outside. Yes, you did.
In terms of grants?
Mm-hmm. And they come, of course, come less frequently in history than they do in science. If you can get your project in the scientific aspect, scientific way, and not political.
Mm-hmm. But you eventually did finish a two-volume book on Dixon.
And I'm a perfectionist, and if you're a perfectionist, it causes you more trouble when you're trying to do research and write.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are perfectionists in that they want to see every last bit of paper involved. And others are perfectionists when it comes to writing.
And which of those do you fall under?
I fall under both of them.
Both of them. So that's why the original manuscript for your Dixon work is here in the archives and is quite a bit longer than the published version?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they had to take it out of my hands,
mm-hmm.
and turn it over to an editor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's... Have you read the note of a new biography of Thomas J. Walsh?
No.
Well, the author of that suffered from the same problem I did. They had to take it out, the University of Illinois Press had to take it out of his hands,
mm-hmm.
and turn it over to an editor.
Later you wrote about race and race riots, is that right?
Earlier.
At a time when really there wasn't a lot in terms of history or people publishing in history on race.
That's right.
What got you interested in writing on that?
Stupidity. Because I happened to come across the Italo-American Incident of 1891. You're familiar with that?
Mm-hmm. But describe it briefly for those who aren't.
And then I did some seminar work on it, got more deeply interested. And then my advisor, who was chairman of the history department, urged me not to go any further with it on the grounds it was a dead end.
Hmm.
It would do for a dissertation, but it wouldn't lead to anything more.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, turned out to be right. But the research was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
There's an... Anyway, the research you could do in a nice part of the world, New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Though issues of race in history have certainly become far more both accepted and popular and would not be considered a dead end now.
Oh, no. But I have a sheaf of books, of course, of the new research. But it was a dead end then. But today they've even used statistics on the problems.
So what was the reaction to you writing that then?
Academically? Oh, I never received much comment, but I didn't have much trouble getting the articles published.
There just simply wasn't interest.
Yes.
Like today.
Today you get almost anything in the field published.
So before we started taping, I was talking to you a little bit about the fact that, you know, you came at a time when the company, the Anaconda Company, still had a strong presence in the state, so much so that it's been called, you know, a company state, company towns, company newspapers. How or to what degree did the company affect the university?
Oh, have you read Louis Levine's book on taxation?
No.
You should. Because he's the one who brought the university into disrepute. He wrote a book on taxation of mines in Montana and proposed ways to increase the taxation and increase the yield. And the company got rid of him, literally. So and then when I started working on Joe Dixon, I wanted to work the company side. And one of its main lobbyists wrote me that he had never heard of Joe Dixon. Then a friend of mine who was with the company asked them about their manuscript policy, and they threw everything out every 5 years. That is, everything not relating to financial problems. So I got nowhere with the company. I would say that... Have you read the new biography of Rankin?
Jeanette Rankin?
Yes. You can see the problem she had.
Being a politician in this state.
And her, if you had available a book on the election of 1928, you'd see that the company had tremendous power. As I think the book makes it fairly clear. Because, and then in 1944, they went after Leif Erikson and elected perhaps America's, Montana's weakest senator, Zales Acton.
The company had him elected.
I would say about... There's a letter in the Walsh collection in which one of Walsh's followers warned him against attacking the company in 1926, saying that when the company goes after you, it's fatal. He said, look at Joe Dixon. I would say that the company may not be interested in history, but they're interested in, they were interested in the present. And they didn't, if they had to have somebody they didn't want, they'd rather have them in Washington than in Helena. which is why your governors had such problems.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, is there any ways you can say that affected the university in terms of being funded through the legislature?
Yes, because the company was opposed to, as much as possible to taxation.
Mm-hmm.
Without taxation, the university can't exist.
Mm-hmm. So simply the funding of the school was affected.
And then the doctrines that you wanted to teach, after all, an economist mulling over the fate of Louis Levine, who would certainly be careful what he said in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. You were also here in 1972 when the state's new constitution was written, which seems to be a turning point for the state and hence the university in terms of company power.
The company essentially committed suicide, then got out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have happened if the price of copper had gone up?
The changes would have been more subtle, slower to take place, for sure. How involved, I mean, as a professor of constitutional history, how involved were faculty members, was the university, in the writing of the new constitution in 72?
I couldn't answer that question.
I know there were a number of law professors here that were involved, young law professors.
I think the faculty did work on it,
mm-hmm.
but how much I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think you had to be elected. God knows I was never going to run for office. Even the Constitutional Convention.
So you taught here from
45 to 79.
So in 34 years, what are some of the major changes that happened in the department and on campus in general?
Again, I can't answer that. Have any major changes occurred? Would be my response.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten bigger enrollment, but then almost everybody else has. The 15,000 I complained about in Minnesota is now 50.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that our increase in size, the only major change is in football.
Mm-hmm.
Because Montana used to have one of the worst football teams extant. Intellectually, we probably haven't kept up because we're using adjunct professors who were underpaid and overworked. No, I would say that we've gotten to the stage where now that we're bigger, we can be as bad as the ones which were bigger earlier.
So the size of the university is not a plus in your mind?
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a plus in your mind?
Well, I've never experienced anything much different. I don't have the experience.
What about the college you went to in Colorado?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, a school of 3,000 is definitely different than a school of 8, 9, 10,000. In that undergraduate courses where your numbers are 5 to 10 people resemble a graduate seminar much more closely.
Oh, that's what we like. Undergraduate seminars.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you brought up the football team because you coached tennis here.
Yes.
For quite a while. And, you know, that's something that has certainly changed. Professors both teaching and coaching.
Oh, my God. Well, it was pure accident again, mm-hmm. as most of my career seems to have been.
How did it come about?
I had coached at Pullman. And since I had coached at Pullman, when Jimmy heard that I had coached at Pullman, he decided that I might like to coach here. But again, it was nothing planned.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would offer that now not only do people not do both of those things, but that often athletics have been seen as extracurricular, if not a distraction from school, much in the way that, you know, you've talked about too large of classrooms being a distraction to learning. How, for you, are athletics important to education?
Oh, my God.
As a supporter of both of them.
I would say that, looking back, I would say that athletics is antithetical to academia. And that includes tennis.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's impossible, almost impossible for one to concentrate on academics and a tennis team simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And then, though it's a whole new era. When the football team was in the Pac-10, along with all the other sports, and yet the football team had one coach and a head coach and two assistants. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then the students will always assume that the athletes are getting breaks. I remember the girl who came up to drop my second quarter of American history. And she said, "Well, I know if I've been an athlete, I got at least a C." Well, I suspect that's a large part of the thinking. And yet the athletes would complain that I was merciless on them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then a member of the tennis team, whom my assistant coach had great hope for, took my history class, got an F, and thus became ineligible. The tennis team was almost riotous. No, you shouldn't do both.
Mm-hmm. Though, you know, in the last week or two, there was an article in the newspaper about, lauding athletics for having the highest graduation rate of any, you know, group or type of student.
I'd like to know where the statistics are,
mm-hmm.
and whom they're comparing them with.
Yeah, I believe it was just an article in the Kaiman, the university's paper, comparing athletes versus non-athletes, just very broadly. And that athletes are graduating at far, far higher rates than non-athletes.
I hope it's true, but I'm a little skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the two have a relationship?
I know that I was a better student because of the coach I had in college.
What sport did you play?
I ran. Was a distance runner. And he was just such a motivating person that it carried over into making me a better student.
Oh.
That's certainly not, you know, an across-the-board assumption on all athletes or all coaches or all students, but that was my experience of it. And I don't know whether I was the rule or the exception. So, you know, you've made it sound like you were fairly controversial as a person and as a professor on campus. Who were some of the people that were your supporters that you got along with and that thought, you know, in many of the same ways you did about class size and the rigor of education?
I would say Burley Miller, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Though he could handle almost any size. Then Jack Van De Wettering. Bob Turner, no. And then outside the department, not many.
You know, I know that you've mentored at least, you know, one person that has gone on to quite a bit of academic success in terms of George Denison was a student of yours and speaks very highly of his time in the classroom with you. What would you consider some of the most important things you did while at the university, your legacy in general?
Well, I had some good students. You've heard of Marty Melosi?
Mm-hmm.
He was a diplomatic history student here, and Marty was astute. He moved from diplomatic history into what I would call public history, because when he went to Texas A&M, there was a diplomatic historian with considerable seniority on him. Then there was Joan Hoff. I would say they were the two best graduate students, two best students I'd had. Then what else? My legacy?
Mm-hmm.
I think I had none.
For people who would have spent the time here when you were here, you know, if I were talking to someone else, what are they going to say about Jules Carlin's time here?
Depends on whom you talk to.
Uh-huh.
Interesting, if I could only... I wonder, for example, what Harry Fritz would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, having spoken with him, he said you were very highly regarded as a teacher and tough, and not many students survived your classes. But those who did were the better for it.
That's kind of him.
So what's kept you here? You've been retired for 25 years?
Yes.
And you still live in Missoula? That seems to be a trend amongst retired faculty and staff, that this place holds them.
Particularly when one must emphasize that I hate the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That this is only the second winter in 25 that I've spent in Missoula.
Mm-hmm.
That's because old age is catching up. But I can't explain it.
Mm-hmm. Do you keep up with the university since you've retired?
To a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But not as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
When I was teaching. In other words, I'm more of a spectator.
Mm-hmm. Well, even as a spectator, you know, you've at this point been either teaching or a spectator in Missoula for 60 years.
Oh, God.
You know, who has been the most effectual president in 60 years and why?
Most effectual?
Mm-hmm.
I would rate them George Denison first, Jimmy McCain second, and Bob Panza third.
Mm-hmm. And what have they done to garner that?
Well, Bob Panza had a successful administration, but it would have been more successful if Larry Gale hadn't died at the age of 40 of a heart attack. Because Panza was going to handle the outside, Larry Gale handled the inside. Which reminds me, I never did tell you what happened to Mel Wren, did I?
No, you should.
I should. Well, he came back from his Maryland experience and then got involved with Larry Gale, because Larry had warned him. Wren used to resign it periodically until he got his way, and Larry said, the next time you resign, I'm going to accept it. Well, Wren decided that he wasn't being treated fairly, and Mort Borden applied for the chairmanship at Toledo. Wren wrote him a letter of recommendation, then took the job himself. So he went off to Toledo with one final blast at Panza and at the university in general. Then he discovered that his wife hated Toledo. She said all her friends were in Missoula. And so Wren decided he'd come back. Well, Coonrod was afraid of him. And so what they decided was that if one person, in order to bring him back, it would have to be a united department. One member alone could kill the proposal. So I refused to go to the meeting on the grounds that I didn't see anything to discuss. He had resigned. And then the next morning, Jack Van de Wettering said, well, the vote was unanimous, but your vote hasn't been counted yet. What do you want to do? So I said, I'm going to stay hold firm. He went to Toledo voluntarily. That's where he can stay. So that's where he stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And in view of all the bloodshed,
mm-hmm,
I have no remorse.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever the chair?
Oh, my God, no. Can you see me carrying out administrative duties?
It doesn't sound like the reputation of you I've heard.
Oh, no, I would never be a chairman.
Uh-huh. So how about Denison? What has he done that earned your accolades?
Oh, he is one of the first presidents, except for the other two, to be able to have a handle on what was really going on at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And then he seems to be very skillful at handling the legislature and the regents.
Mm-hmm. And he was one of your students.
Well, there are other students of mine who I wouldn't recommend.
So do you have any other memories or thoughts or comments about your time here that you'd like to share?
I can't think of any at the moment.
No favorite memories of your time here?
Well, as a perfectionist, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Good.